The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
I'm Scott Wapner, and you're listening to CNBC's Halftime Report, the podcast, the most profitable hour of the trading day. We record this live weekdays at 12 Eastern. Listen in.
You're listening to Halftime Report, in progress. You're listening to Halftime Report, in progress. You're listening to Halftime Report, in progress. You're listening to Halftime Report, in progress.
I do agree. Yeah.
Okay. The chairman asked you for your thoughts on withdrawing or reproposing the Basel III endgame proposal. Have you specifically discussed withdrawing the proposal with Vice Chairman Michael Barr or the other governors?
So I don't want to get into our internal doings, but I will say that I understand it is a live option. Again, we're not at a stage of being able to even have that discussion yet because we've got to decide first what changes do we think are appropriate, and that'll take a little time. And then the question will be reproposal. What I said is, when we get to that point, if reproposal is the right thing to do, we're not going to hesitate at all. It's a perfectly live option.
All right. In the current environment we have in politics in this country, there's not a lot that you find bipartisan agreement on, but I think you could find some agreement in withdrawing that proposal. Can you explain the importance of broad consensus at the Fed on proposals like B3E? Are you concerned with recent trends of disagreement among board members related to major proposals?
So I think we're going to get to broad consensus at the Fed. I do. I think it's very important. You know, this has been our culture that we try to find common ground, and we've been able to do that in the regulatory space, and I expect we will be here as well. And
so
I'm committed to that.
Could it be that we're seeing this level of disagreement because of extreme measures that are being taken now that may not have been taken in the past? I mean, a total difference of opinion and understanding and philosophy regarding free market economy.
I won't speculate, but I will point out that four of the seven governors during the open board meeting at which we put it out for comment expressed real concerns, very specific concerns about the proposal, and said we would look at the comments when they came in, and that's what we're doing.
All right. Do you feel that they have validity in their concerns?
I was one of the four, so yes.
with the few seconds I have remaining, there's a recent report of FinCEN working with financial institutions to query legal purchases made by American citizens. Has the Federal Reserve been instructed within the past 3 years by Treasury or anyone else to search Americans' legal transactions?
Not that I know of, no.
Okay, thank you. I yield back.
Senator from Illinois, Mr. Foster is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for being here. As Ben remarked, there's a near-term emergency to get the $60 billion in military assistance to Ukraine. And separate from that, there remains a longer-term need for reconstruction assistance to Ukraine, which the World Bank estimates is somewhere north of $400 billion. Now, at the start of the Russian invasion, the free democracies of the world froze roughly $300 billion in Russian currency assets, primarily at European banks and financial institutions. And the Biden administration and many of our allies have recently taken the stance that those assets should be leveraged somehow to provide reconstruction resources to Ukraine. I support this concept, and I believe that additional action should be taken to ensure that we hold Russia accountable. But there are real concerns on the impact that this might have on central banking system, on the primacy of the dollar, the euro, and so on. And so my question is, have you seen just the act of freezing these assets and not seizing them, but simply freezing them, have you seen deleterious effects on the the primacy of the dollar, the confidence in the central banking system. Is there any visible downside from the act of freezing that's visible so far in the 2 years since we've done it?
I can't point to any. I can't point to any.
Okay, so that's an interesting observation when we think of taking the additional step of actually seizing them, that at least so far, because, you know, to my mind, having them frozen is as violent as violent as seizing them outright. And so that's interesting that so far we haven't seen that. Now, in terms of the Basel III and so on, there is a there's a frustration I've had over the fact that directionally the effects of these are clear, but the magnitude of effects are not. You know, for example, if you talk about the effect on the prices seen by derivative end users of increased capital requirement, directionally it's clear. If you raise capital requirements, banks will withdraw from these markets to some extent. Other players will step in partly and take up part of the slack, and the spreads will increase and so on. Is the data that you've collected enough for you to actually estimate the magnitude of these effects instead of simply the direction?
I think it's really hard to get down to the micro level and try to assess that, because you're right, there would be multiple effects. But you do know that you know the direction, you know what the sign is.
That's right, but if you can avoid financial crises with a microscopic increase in prices seen by end users, that's one thing. If it's a very large difference in the price, so the magnitude matters a lot when you're doing these balancing things. And a lot of it depends on, actually, you need a model for how the different market players will react. And is that really not going to be in the scope of the analysis that you anticipate from the quantitative?
I believe we have done some work on that, and I think the banks and other participants have done work on that as well and come up with a range of answers. But there are just an awful lot of variables in these equations, so it's hard to say with any confidence. It's hard to, the job of deciding the precise level of appropriate capital is a hard one.
Yeah. And now with, with 10 years, we've had two major crises with both a fiscal and a monetary response. Are there the lessons that you can learn now that, I believe, and it seems like your testimony indicates, that we're kind of approaching back to normal now? And we've seen in the crisis of 15 years ago, we saw what many people thought was an inadequate fiscal response, that the fiscal response was, less than half of the output gap. And we limited by political, political will to do things. And then, of course, you were limited by the zero bound in what you could do for most of a decade, and we had a long recovery. And the comparison, to the COVID recovery has been very sharp, and it's quite remarkably put us right back on that track. Are there any lessons that you've sort of drawn about the importance of the getting the right balance of fiscal and monetary response to these shocks?
So we think about that a lot, and I think I have to start by saying it's too soon to really tell, because the answers you would give today, the picture looks very different than what it looked like a year ago. And so, and a year from now, we'll be looking back going and saying, we've learned so much more. So I think the pandemic is still writing the story of our economy right now, and we should just be prepared to be surprised with the next chapter, as we were with 2023, the very strong growth, the sharp decline in inflation while the labor market remained very strong. Very few forecasters had that, but we can talk about it.
Gentleman's time has expired. We'll now go to the gentleman from Ohio, Mr. Davidson, for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman. Chairman Powell, thank you for being here today and for your testimony. I'd like to start off, first of all, by completely echoing everything Congressman Barr said. A lot of us have talked about Basel III endgame, and I think Congressman Barr kind of nailed the thought process. I do hope you'll kind of withdraw that and take the comments you've heard from here and from so many others about the hazards with the current approach. But I'd also like to address one of the other practices by the Federal Reserve, and it's the practice of paying interest on excess reserve balances held with the Fed accounts. It's my strong belief that rewarding banks with returns for taking no market risks actually harms our economy, and it discourages financial institutions from lending money into the economy. Instead, they park it at the Fed. Now, this has little to no impact on very large corporations, but it can have a crippling impact on small and mid-market firms. And we especially saw this in the long recovery as Dodd-Frank was implemented in the Obama years, transitioned to the Trump years. We changed some of that mindset with a lot of other policies, but we saw a strong surging economy. So our countrymen pay a price for this market distortion by the Fed in two ways. First, they're unable to obtain loans at competitive rates because the money's sucked out of the market. Frankly, a lot of them don't even have access to lending except through bank capital. So it forces them into other forms of capital, equity capital, and others. Second, they ultimately pay higher rates whenever they have these alternative means of capital. And so today I've introduced a prohibition on the IOER Act, which would prohibit the Federal Reserve from paying interest on excess reserves. By eliminating IOER, we can begin to return our economy to the undistorted free market economy it's supposed to have. You know, the alternative is you could simply raise requirements. We see some of those moral hazards when you do it across the board with approach like Basel. So what's your case for why you should keep paying interest on excess reserves?
Well, we don't see the downsides that you're talking about. You know, banks have a cost of funds and they have what they can earn, and that's what really matters is the spread.
And if they wanted to do it, they could simply buy treasuries on their own, and they could do that independently. I suppose they can independently keep it at the Fed, but they don't have to buy, they don't even have to put it on their own balance sheets in the same way. They've got immediate liquidity with Fed over it. Overnight account. So I don't see how that's different than what they could already do.
What I was going to say was, you know, banks can earn a much bigger spread by lending to corporates. So their incentive to lend is the same as it always was. This doesn't affect that. You know, really, it's they have a cost of funds and they have the ability to have reserves. But you know that's not going to they're not earning a profit on that. So, or a big one, they can earn a much bigger profit by lending to small corporates.
Well, speaking of profit, I mean, the Federal Reserve isn't officially supposed to be a for-profit corporation, but you are supposed to pay for your operating costs off of positive cash flow. And right now, the Fed doesn't have positive cash flow. In fact, the Fed has negative cash flow. So it's not entirely unrelated that the Federal Reserve operated at a $114.3 billion loss in 2023 and currently is carrying a $133 billion loss on its balance sheet this year. So it's, you know, not the right approach, I think, to be paying essentially that much out in excess reserves to banks that are holding capital in the Fed when they could be deploying it into the market. So right now, the interest you're paying banks and money market funds exceeds the income you're getting on the $7.6 trillion balance sheet assets that you have to the tune of $133 billion asset. So, you know, effectively the Fed is operating at an operating loss. So what's the path back to cash flow positivity for the Fed?
As you know, for many years during the QE, large balance sheet period, we've contributed way over $1 trillion in net earnings to the bank, which to the Treasury Department. So you can't look at the loss without mentioning that we've been giving effectively $100 billion a year in profits every year to the Treasury Department. So
the market doesn't joke around. So why would you? Get serious. Choose Tasty Trade. Tasty Trade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tasty Trade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
What does it mean to be rich? Is it having more stories to share or time to give? Is it being able to keep your loved ones close or travel somewhere far away? At Edward Jones, we believe the key to being rich is knowing what counts. Your dedicated financial advisor will take a comprehensive approach to your financial strategy to help support what truly matters to you. EdwardJones.com/findyourrich. Edward Jones, member SIPC.
The other side of that is when we raise rates to do the job you've assigned us to get inflation under control, when we do that, we absorb paper losses. It has no effect on our operating the way we operate the Fed. And you know, if we retained all the earnings we have, then it wouldn't be a problem. But we don't do that. We give that money to Treasury.
Thank you. And I think the last thing is I just encourage you to halt any effort to develop a central bank digital currency. It doesn't need designed, developed, and it certainly doesn't need established. I yield.
The gentlewoman from Ohio, Ms. Beatty. Mrs. Beatty, is recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you to our ranking member, and thank you, Director Powell, for being here. Let me start by saying thank you for the monetary report. I've had a chance to try to peruse it, and there are headings in there that says the labor market remains strong. You'd probably agree to that, your report.
I would.
Let that say that's a yes. Also, it talks about unemployment rates being low by historical standards. You'd agree with that? It also states that the global pandemic played a huge role with the inflation rate, and inflation rates are on the decline, as reported in several charts in here, and also substantiated by the Federal Reserve of New York and Michigan surveys that I've read. It also talks about job gains and uses the word robust jobs. So I want to thank you for educating us on that. And Mr. Chairman, I'd like the record to show that all of this also resulted during the Biden-Harris administration of making sure. So often we hear in this committee and other committees about what the administration is not doing and what our economy and jobs look like. Now let me move on to something that's very dear to me and want to thank our ranking member for bringing it up, and that's the lack of affordable housing, which is one of the primary things that I hear about when I'm back home. I'm on more panels to try to explain what you do, what we do, or oftentimes what we don't do and why we have this. While I know that interest rate hikes have successfully brought down the inflation, rising rates have also had an adverse effect on the cost and the pace of housing construction and costs. Are you concerned about the effects that interest rate hikes are having on the cost of financing new construction? And the second part, how do you expect to control for long-term housing inflation that might have a potential rate cut, how it might affect that?
So our policy to bring inflation down is to raise interest rates, and that works through several channels. One of them is probably the most important, is interest-sensitive spending. And within that, you have housing and durable goods and things like that. So, you know, during the early days of the pandemic, the housing industry was about to all go bankrupt. And all of the facilities that we did really supported that industry through their critical time. When we're going in the other direction, when we're raising rates, housing is definitely affected. We understand that. It's not something we want to have happen, just it is the reality that housing will slow a lot when you raise interest rates. We've done that, and we're doing it for the longer-run benefit of the people we serve to restore price stability, which is beyond value for people to have price stability. We get it that in the near term, that's higher rates, that's fewer sales, people are locked into low-rate mortgages. We get all that, but we got to do this because it'll benefit the country and people in the longer run.
And I have a great appreciation for that. But also, when I go back home to the district, what I hear a lot from agencies and individuals who work with advocacy groups, that the effects of interest rate hikes are not borne equally to all American households. So we hear that, and there's no doubt that low-income and minority communities are hit the highest or the hardest by these monetary policy changes. Black households and business owners have historically faced challenges with home ownership and access to capital, and they're disproportionately impacted by the rate hikes. Does the Fed, do you have anything that you could help me with this dilemma and how we can better achieve economic goals in a more precise and equitable manner?
So I think it's working. You see inflation coming down, and that's why I do think it's likely at some time this year, if the economy, you know, proceeds along the path we expect, that we will begin to reduce rates. So that's really the path that we're on, and I do hope it works out that way.
And when you say, I don't have a lot of time, but when you say economy, what does that mean? Helping poor people and black people get more jobs, more money?
So our forecast is for continued strong growth, a continued strong labor market with, you know, wages going up and also with inflation coming down. So that kind of an economy.
Okay. My time is up. I yield back. Thank you.
The gentleman from Tennessee, Mr. Rose, is now recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Chairman McHenry and Ranking Member Waters, for holding this hearing, and thank you, Chair Powell, for being with us today. I'd like to start by discussing the independent automated teller machine owners or operators section of the Bank Secrecy Act examination manual. I want to ensure that financial institutions will not be discouraged from providing banking services to the independently owned ATM industry. In 2021, you made it clear that the industry does not automatically present a higher risk for illicit finance. I'd like to know what efforts have been made by the Federal Reserve to fully communicate that position to financial institutions across the country.
I will have to get back to you on that one.
All right. Thank you. Well, so I might just add, listening to independent ATM operators over the time that I've served in Congress, I've come to understand that, unfortunately, and it was in the Bank Examiner's Manual up until just about a couple years ago, these operators were identified as being extraordinarily risky, and that was causing them to be debanked in many cases. So I do hope that you'll take a look at that and make sure that we're communicating that to financial institutions and, most importantly, to the regulators. Chair Powell, Tennessee is home to over 1,000 foreign-based businesses that have chosen to invest in our state and create more than 160,000 jobs. These jobs are reliant upon cross-border financing provided by global banks, including foreign banking organizations. The Federal Reserve has long maintained the principles of national treatment and equality of competitive opportunity when regulating foreign banks and assessing them based on their U.S. operations. Are you still committed to these principles?
Yes.
And how will these principles be reflected as you move to finalize the Basel Endgame proposal?
So we have received a whole separate set of comments from the foreign banks, and we'll look at those, very much in that spirit and make appropriate changes.
Thank you. Chair Powell, the Basel III Endgame will incentivize firms to transfer credit risks off their balance sheets. One avenue for such a transfer is synthetic securitization, the framework of which must be approved by the Federal Reserve. However, it is my understanding that there is a substantial backlog of reviews and approvals of these securitization frameworks. It is concerning that the Federal Reserve is directing the risk transfer, yet also impeding it, in my view. Can you commit to reviewing this approval process and taking steps to reduce the backlog of pending securitization applications?
So, as I understand it, these transactions are becoming popular right now. There's a lot of appetite to do them, and we're not stopping them. We're just being careful because, you know, there were similar things that happened about credit risk transfer during the global financial crisis that didn't actually work out. So we want to make sure that these structures really do actually durably transfer. And we think that they do, but we just need to be careful because, the last experience with these was difficult back in the crisis, in the last crisis. So it's just something that we're not intending to slow these down, and I think we'll try to get through it.
Is it a lack of available resources to apply to the approval process, or is it an intentional slow walking to make sure that every I is dotted, every T crossed?
I don't actually know, but what I've been told is we're not stopping these, but we're going to be careful with them and just be absolutely careful that they really do transfer credit risk in a durable, kind of sustained way. And that's the thing, and I don't think it's an intention to go slow or to have a backlog. It's just, and so I don't know what the staffing issue is. We'll check.
All right, thank you. As the Federal Reserve continues to consider proposals designed and debated in Europe, such as Basel III, has the Federal Reserve's Supervisory Climate Committee or the Financial Stability Committee had any discussions regarding the adoption of ESG risks in capital requirements?
I don't know.
Has there been any discussion in other committees regarding the adoption of ESG risks in capital requirements?
Any discussion? I really don't know. Let me say that's not something we're considering, but when you ask me any discussion, I don't know.
It's not a priority in capital requirements.
To put it mildly, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. I see my time is running out. I appreciate your answers and any further light you can shed on those matters, I'd appreciate. I yield back, Mr. Chairman.
The gentleman from Illinois, Mr. Kasten, is now recognized for 5 minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and thank you, Mr. Chairman, for being here today. I want to start, Dan, just with following up on the exchange you had with Mr. Sherman. As I think you know, I led a letter with 106 of my colleagues with concerns about specifically the clean energy tax equity provisions in Basel. I appreciate your commitment to look at that. I wonder if I could just put a little bit of a sharper point on it. Can you look at that before the rule is finalized and potentially issue some sort of an addendum to the rule? The concern I have is the number of banks who are a little bit frozen right now waiting for some clarity on that, and I'd prefer we not slow down the rate of clean energy investing in our country if we don't have to.
I don't know. I mean, I think there's a proposal, and we're well aware of the commentary, and we're going to react appropriately. I don't know that we can pull one thing out of line and deal with it. But we're making good progress, and I think we'll be back soon with some answers.
Okay. Well, time is of the essence. Appreciate anything you can do. Second thing, good thing about going late here, you get to follow up. I want to follow up on your discussion with Congresswoman Garcia here. I really appreciated your comments in the 60 Minutes interview last month when you mentioned that immigration is a big part of the story of the labor market coming back into balance. Now, generally, and correct me if I'm wrong, more immigration is generally going to ease inflationary pressure. Is that all else equal? Is that a safe characterization?
You know, it's probably closer to neutral, actually, because you know people come in, they also spend. You know, so it's not clear that immigrants coming in, they add to GDP.
Okay, so either we're going to get economic growth and/or downward pressure on wages.
More workers, that might wages might go up a little bit less, but at the same time they're also spending. So we had this conversation. It depends on what you assume, but I think it's better to just assume it's conversation. It depends on what you assume. 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 Conversation. It depends on...
The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tasty Trade. Tasty Trade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tasty Trade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
It depends on what you assume conversation. 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 It depends on what you as 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 conversation. It depends on what you assertion. 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 It depends on what you assume conversation. 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 It depends on what you assume conversation.
Swing into summer and save when you go pro. Invest with an advantage. Be prepared for any market with CNBC Pro's exclusive stock screener, Investor Playbook, and Stock Picks. With CNBC Pro, you'll have the strategy and tools you need to reach your goals. Get Pro's unrivaled access and essential tools with a special offer for a limited time. Go to cnbc.com/prosale now.